All the wayward wind
is a restless wind. Good morning and welcome to our show, Downtown Crossroads. We have an incredibly exciting guest with us this morning, Mike the Poet, and he's part of our series, Deep Issues Surrounding Downtown. He's going to answer questions about poetry, activism, and the poetry community. We're taking a break from our usual selection of downtown celebrities to focus a bit more on the arts. And Mike the Poet is one of the most well-known poets in the city. And we want to get right to his interview. And I'll be treating you this morning, I'm Ed Rosenthal, to one of my poems about a historic building. Just because Mike's here as our guest, and he loves that stuff. So say hello to the audience.
Hey, good afternoon. Good morning and good afternoon, Los Angeles. Here we are. It's great to be here.
Say, Mike, you know, we see you all over the place, and I really think you've become the leading poet in the city. I'm not talking about academic accolades or anything like that, but how did you develop your interest in poetry?
I think, you know, like many people, I did write poems as a kid and as a teenager. I would say, though, my interest in poetry really, really, really took off in the early 90s. I graduated in high school the year of the 1992 riots. And that was actually a big part of who I became, because the city was in such turmoil at the time. But I was always around a group of people. I was always a bridge builder. I was always a guy that had a friend in a lot of neighborhoods. So I was always driving around L.A., riding the bus around L.A. And my freshman year at UCLA, there was a lot of sort of anti-LA propaganda in the air. Remember following the riots, and then we had all those fires in 93. And so in the early 90s, there was this spirit of anti-LA, and I loved LA, and I'd already loved it from my grandfather. So I was riding around the city, and I was just writing about everything I saw. And so I was just writing a ton of poems. And I think in a lot of ways, I was kind of an unconscious poet. It wasn't until about 2021, about my second or third year at UCLA, where I started maybe learning more. But originally, it was just raw, just written in the notebook. And I think it was the spirit of the times that led me to write poetry. And I mean, I also just liked to write, and I liked music a lot. I liked hip hop music. And my grandfather was also a musician who played the piano. And so I think the arts were kind of in my blood as it was, but it was also the social conditions of LA. And
that sounds great. I noticed you used the word riots instead of uprising. Is that a conscious choice?
You know, I mean, I guess it was both. I mean, I guess, you know, it was that time, there was so much turmoil in the air, and there was so much tension that...
This was right after the Rodney King verdict.
The Rodney King verdict, yeah.
I'm sure all our listeners know about that, since it was all over national TV, that after Rodney King suffered a substantial beating from LAPD, the officers were acquitted.
Yeah.
And that's what triggered these disturbances.
I mean, well, it was funny because, for example, when the LaTosha Harlan shooting, one of my best friends had been a Korean guy and his parents owned a bunch of liquor stores. But for example, my Korean friend, their family was maybe different. They had a liquor store in North Long Beach, which was a very tough neighborhood at the time. But my friend, his parents, they were aware of building good relations with the neighbors. And so his uncle Tony was a guy who knew, he would know all the locals in the neighborhood, and he made sure that he was friendly with people. So even though there were all these tensions, I had plenty of friends that, you know, when there was all this black and Korean tension, my best friends were black and Korean, you know? And so in the middle of all of that, I think there was a lot of us young people that were 18, 19, 20 at the time that we wanted to bring the city together.
Grow up in LA?
Well, I actually went to high school in Cerritos. So, I mean, I guess technically,
well, LA, that's
County, LA County. Yeah. And my parents went to Washington High School in South LA. My dad grew up in Inglewood. My mom grew up at Western and Manchester. My grandparents all grew up in LA. And, my mom's dad went to Jefferson High School. My dad's dad went to Manual Arts. My mom's mom went to Washington High School. My dad's mom went to Polytechnic High School, when it is where Trade Tech is now. So I have all these LA roots, and my grandmother never moved out of Inglewood. She they tried to move her out of Inglewood. She didn't want to. So.
Wow. Who tried to move her out?
Well, not really, but my uncle, towards the end of her life was saying, well, you know, if you want to go to either a nursing home or he was going to buy her a small home, you know, in the South Bay or this or that, you know, she was just very middle class, but she was happy in the home and she lived in the home for 55 years. You know what I mean? She didn't see any reason to move out of the neighborhood. She lived on Van Ness in Imperial. And as a matter of fact, my family still owns that house. But
you know, you seem to be jumping right to social issues, which is great. Do you think, well, first of all, as a poet, do you have a responsibility to take on social and political issues? Or is that not the job of a poet?
I personally, myself, yes, I take that job on. And I like to take that role on as a poet. And my poets that I usually like do. There are some that argue that, oh, that poetry shouldn't be in, you know, such as the kind of the new critics. And there's certain schools of academic poets and people that, oh, you know, art for art's sake. And art for art's sake is cool. But the poetry I always liked was a little bit more activist or was a little bit more about social issues. And I like poetry that's relevant, that means something.
Well, one of my favorite poets, probably the favorite poet, is Garcia Lorca.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly was political.
Mm-hmm.
And he was murdered for his...
By the Spanish government.
Right. Probably for a combination of being gay and for, you know, being a political activist. What are some of those poets you're talking about?
Yeah, Lorca, definitely. But like I was telling you earlier, Ginsberg and Langston Hughes were some of my favorite poets. But also, I mean, right now, the current guy that I recently only found out about in the last 3 or 4 years is this really interesting Australian vegan anarchist, this guy named John Kinsella. But John Kinsella, his whole thing is he's defending the Aborigines in Australia. And he won't even fly in airplanes because he's against the anti-carbon footprint and all that. I mean, he's pretty hardcore of an activist. But some of his poetry is really good. Some of it's a little esoteric. But I've liked those. There's so many poets. I mean, originally, I kind of came up in the slam scene, but I'm not so much into the slam thing. But some of the performance poets, I mean, I used to really like Saul Williams a lot. I mean, I still do, but I'm not as influenced by that scene anymore. I even like some of the academic poets, but I mean, people like Ginsberg and I also, for that matter, the Black Arts Movement. In L.A., there was the Watts Writers Workshop, and I recently just did an article about the writers of the world stage and the poet Kamau Daoud, who's from City Lights Books, and Kamau Daoud from Leimert Park.
Right, I've heard him.
He's amazing, but he was never interested in the careerism. Like, as a matter of fact, I've talked to him before. His granddaughter was in my class for a while, and he never pursued. He was so busy doing poetry in prisons and churches and weddings and community activism that he should have a lot more books out. He's great, but he never pursued it. City Lights, from what I understand, actually chased him down. Like, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, they sent somebody to get his book published, but he never pursued the fame. He was just so. Some of my favorite poets are kind of more on that side of things.
Do you have one of your poems that are here with us today that's like that? That's a public poem?
There's a lot of public poems I have. Yeah, I have many different public poems, but yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Can you read one for us?
Or
one by memory?
Yeah, this is one for memory I have that's, this is called The New Beautiful, and it's pretty activism, and it's very much of a public poem. Should I go ahead and do it? Okay.
That's great. Here we have our first poem read by one of our guests, Mike the Poet, and here he goes.
All right. It's called The New Beautiful. Back to the people. Back to the people. Back to the people. Speak to the soul. Hear the whole. Behold the beautiful in your own backyard. Behold the beautiful in your own backyard, real wood instead of fool's gold. We are the face of the new beautiful. And we call for a revolution of values. We commit to correct the decadent institutions. We reject violence, racist, fascist, oppressors, imperialists. And as our country builds more prisons, we ask, who are the real criminals? Some have said we live in the age of know nothing. Well, you better know something, you'll get what's coming to you. The arrogant figureheads would like to keep us ignorant. That's how they railroad through crooked policy and get rich. And the more ignorant we remain, the richer they get. Learned helplessness comes from laziness. If you never take action, it increases powerlessness and helps the smug stay prosperous. We need to learn our history, overcome apathy. Knowledge is a commodity, and the rise of technology has leveled the playing field. You can either build or destroy. And video games have become the dominant form of world entertainment. Yes, the graphics are iller than a hospital, but still virtual reality can be insanity, and the Matrix is real, Babylon circuitry. The world is changing. We're at a crossroads. The new beautiful triumphs truth and righteousness over greed and ego. It's education, not misinformation. It's time for transformation, justice, equality, and love. Enough is enough. Tear the walls down. No one is illegal. The collective ritual of people coming together from all walks is extremely powerful. So let the righteous join in liberation. Mobilize the dispossessed and marginalized. All hail the artists, vanguards of righteousness, magicians for a better tomorrow, fighting the good fight. Poets unite, keep the verse tight. Writers write, write the light. Singer-songwriters write songs to sing, sing us songs of freedom. Turntablists turn tables to turn the tables. Painters paint the difference. Paint down Babylon, smash down artifice, light up consciousness, conscious vibrations. We call for revolution of values. We need to value each other. Serve others, sisters and brothers, worldwide love, compassion, respect, ritual, global awareness, cosmic awareness, one people. Awaken to your potential. We are spiritual vessels. Set sail. Feel the sun now. Antennas to the future, and together we are the movement. We express solidarity to freedom fighters throughout the universe, respect to the brilliant massive, and infinite gratitude to the creator. Thanks for the transmissions. We've been listening. The broadcast says, create a new society, overthrow the oligarchy, and teach love and work with urgency. Unite souls. Hope is a new hot commodity. Back to the people. Back to the people. Back to the people. Speak to the soul. Hear the whole. Behold the beautiful in your own backyard. Real wood instead of fool's gold. We are the face of the new beautiful.
Wow. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
You know, I wonder if part of being the face of the new beautiful is helping other people and being open to them. Now, I know helping other poets seems to be part of your mission.
Yes, sir.
You and Don Kingfisher Campbell and some other people. And you commented on that at the Beyond Baroque's award dinner.
Yes, sir.
Where you were honored. You shared, not all poets are helpful to you, but Beyond Baroque was. Why is nurturing others part of your approach?
Well, you know, many reasons. Number one, a few people nurtured me. But number two, it's fun. I mean, it's more fun to create community. And I'll say some of it, and this is sort of a tangent, but it'll come back to your question. I have a really great friend. He now lives in Brooklyn, but we did poetry together for 15 years, and we met our freshman year at UCLA, and my buddy Phil. And when I was just writing in my notebook, and when I was just, you know, 20, 21, 22 years old, he always used to tell me, like, not that I wasn't confident, but I just, like, he encouraged me to perform. My friend Phil encouraged me to, like, share my work more. And some of my early breaks were just because he believed in me. And he'd been a soccer star at UCLA. And actually, if he hadn't torn his ACL on his knee, he was going to go play professional soccer, the MLS. A bunch of our old friends are all, like, soccer players and played on the U.S. Olympic team. And I was never a soccer player, but I kind of had my, at UCLA, I was in all these different crowds. But anyway, to make a long story short, my buddy Phil, he gave me a lot of, he believed in me a lot. And I mean, I've always been a guy who liked people anyway, but we traded books and this camaraderie that we had. Next thing you know, in our early 20s, we had a whole group of friends around us. And, you know, not just our girlfriends, but, you know, we knew painters, we knew musicians. And so I kind of grew up in this art community, and I like community. And I mean, I don't have a chance to hang around with everyone as much as we used to, but the community is fun. I mean, and it builds each other. And I think you can learn a lot from other people. And so I like to have the community as much as possible. As I said, it's not always possible because we work or this or that. And, you know, our community isn't tight as it used to be because we're all married now and we're all having kids and this and that. But I like community.
Yeah, I noticed when I was doing some poetry for Blankenship Ballet that there's an arts community gathered around them. It wasn't at all like real estate because there were just a bunch of people participating without regard to their reward.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from my industry. you know, there's a history of great poets, really great poets, making themselves available to others, including some rough characters.
Yeah.
Charles Bukowski, he's probably, if not the most famous, one of the most famous L.A. poets,
yes,
even though he's really a San Pedro poet.
Right.
He would give detailed correspondence and answers to unknown writers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ezra Pound, a fascist, mm-hmm. was imprisoned by the U.S., he still was lauded by poets for helping other poets.
Yeah.
Do you have any reflections on that, on these kind of rough characters and being helpful to others?
Yeah, you know, I mean,
it's kind of a confusing question.
No, it's interesting. Well, I mean, even, okay, one of the, probably the second most famous poet in L.A. besides Bukowski would maybe be Wanda Coleman.
Right.
And she was very, very nice to me when I was in my early 20s. I had read a bunch of her books already, and I was almost a little intimidated by her, but I approached her, and she was very kind to me. And you know, some people have been afraid of her a little bit, or that she was tough, or this or that, but... a lot of these poets, you know, if you're really sincere and just say, hey, I'm writing, or I'm up and coming, or I'm young and I'm interested in this. And I found that if you approach them humbly, most of them are, I mean, not every one of them, but a lot of them are pretty nice. And part of why I wanted to, I'll tell you some of the other poets that were kind to me. Luis Rodriguez was very nice to me. And
now he's the author of
Always
Concrete
Running.
River, right?
Yes, Concrete River, Always Running, a number of books. Good man. And he... he opened up a bookstore in Pacoima, Sylmar out there because it's a desert of culture. There's no art out there.
Still open?
Yes, it's called Tia Chucha's.
Wow.
And if you ever get a chance, go connect with him. He's a heck of a nice guy, and he's mentoring all kinds of youth out there. And he goes and speaks at prisons, but he's the nicest guy you'll ever meet, and he gives so much of himself, and he actually goes and speaks all over the world, and there's even a school, elementary, there's this some Chicano activist in the Midwest named a school after him.
Well, they should. His poetry really is what I call public poetry.
Yes, yes.
He addresses certain issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you know anyone else in L.A. that's like Luis Rodriguez?
A few others. You know, Lewis McAdams, who founded the Friends of the L.A. River, is a really good man, and he's also doing public poetry. And he'd actually been kind of one of the youngest members of the New York School, and he knew Frank O'Hara, and he was kind of mentored by Ted Berrigan, and he got a master's at Princeton in the mid-60s. Lewis McAdams came to L.A. in 1980, and he founded the Friends of the L.A. River in 1985.
Right, I remember that. He's a friend, and I even read at some of their events. But I didn't know all of this. You're saying he was involved in the New York School?
Yeah, and he did a bunch of stuff in Bolinas in the 70s in San Francisco. And also, I met Lewis in my early 20s. I met him in 1999, and he was very kind to me. But I will say that, like, Luis Rodriguez, Wanda Coleman, Kamau Daoud, there's some other figures as well, but those guys have been very kind to the younger generation, and not only are they exceptional in their own work, but they treated me so well that I've always been a guy who likes people anyway, but I think of their models, and my loyalty towards them keeps me mentoring the youth, and I'm very thankful to them. I have a big place in my heart for them.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What's it like to be as young as you are and still be able to help even younger poets?
You know, it's fun. And also, they kind of keep me young, too, because my teaching job was, I had it for 3 years. Now, I mean, I'm doing a lot of guest speaking, but I taught at that high school View Park for 3 years, and I became extremely close with those students, just a great group of students. But also, some of it was as some of the own stress levels of my own life were increasing, those kids are so fun that they kind of remind me to stay young. You know what I mean? Like, as I'm, you know, trying to pay my bills and, you know, pay off my college loans and this and that and all the stress. So I like working with the teenagers because partially they keep you young, and they're a lot of fun. They're really, really a lot of fun. And I think one of my biggest secrets as a teacher is I just give them permission to be a poet. I mean, I do teach them some technical stuff, but I mean, first of all, I think I know one of my strengths as a teacher is just, I'm really good at finding young talent and kind of lighting the fire. You know, I'm a catalyst. I know that's one of my main roles.
Wow, I hope that applies to 67-year-olds. Say, you seem to network very easily. How do you do that? How'd you arrange getting that great location for your readings in Hollywood? Did you have a relationship with the landlord? How did you get prominent poets like Laurel Ann Bogan to read and draw a crowd? Does this come naturally? Tell us about this, about networking, the groups you're involved with, and how is it that comes so naturally to you to be doing that?
I mean, it is a little bit of practice, and also, like, the Stella Adler, where we did that reading, I'm a part-time teacher there, and I'm going to be teaching a one-day-a-week workshop for them, for example, in about 2 or 3 weeks, for 8 weeks or something, and I was doing tours in Hollywood for Redline Tours for a long time, and I still do sometimes. And I got to know the Stella Adler Academy, and they bought, the guy who runs it bought my first book in 06, and we got along really well. And
what's his name?
Jack Rogers. Jack Rogers is a great man, and he was actually Stella Adler's personal assistant for a while before she passed in the 80s. But Jack and I just developed a relationship, and I mean, there were a lot of years in the late 90s, early 2000s where I was not the quiet guy in the corner, but there was a number of years where I was kind of paying my dues and observing things, and it was only after, you know, the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years where really doors started opening. So there was probably 5, 6, 7 years where I was not the guy in the background, but I mean, I've been kind of evolving, you know what I mean? And like the Stella Adler told me in 06, 07, I'm actually going to start doing that event again at some point. It had been on hold a little bit, partially because of grad school and my daughter and just trying to be home more with my wife as much as possible. But I think I like to make friends, and also I like symbiotic relationships. Like the Adler liked the fact that I was doing a multi-generational poetry reading, and they actually let me use the space for free because I didn't charge anything. Now, if I were to charge things, then I would have been, but they thought what I was doing was community service. So I try to strike up strategic partnerships where it's a win-win situation, where it's just, they liked it because, okay, he's bringing the arts here, he's bringing these different people here, but it was also open that if any of the actors wanted to do a poem, they could do it. And I try to keep it real equitable, and I find that if I keep a community spirit, usually people open the doors.
Well, we kind of covered this, but I want to ask you again. In Poet in New York, Garcia Lorca composed beautiful poetry, but he nonetheless captured good and bad about the city, leaving readers with some implied moral implications.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about that a little bit more? I know you mentioned Luis Rodriguez. Should poets be doing that?
I think so. I
know Louis McAdams was an activist, and he was instrumental in helping the LA River redevelop.
Yes, sir.
And it's an ongoing process, but he was there right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Should poets be taking on issues like that, like downtown?
I think so. I mean, I feel like the people that say, oh, no, poets shouldn't, you know, I mean, I know they're all conceptual and this and that, but I like it to mean something to the real world. To me, it's then poetry actually means something, because otherwise it can be just, what's the word, solipsistic, you know, a little just too self-absorbed. I mean, there are some people that write that sort of self-absorbed poetry, but I'm not really into that. I mean, that's why I'm actually...
You mean confessional style?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes confessional can be good, but sometimes too much confessional... Sylvia Plath is amazing. There's no question about that. But sometimes too much confessional is... It's a fine line to make the personal universal. You know what I mean? It's a fine line. I mean, I'm not anti anything, but I'm not always pro confessional. You know what I mean?
Right.
But when it's done right, if it's done artfully, and if there's a way to do it and you can make the personal universal, I'm all for it. I mean, I try not to be too, rigid. I'm not too rigid, but I think poets do have a responsibility. And
that responsibility?
There's a number of responsibilities, but I mean even like Neruda was his responsibility. You know, he was
big activist.
Yeah, he was about the people. You know, and I read his memoir. It was great. And he was talking about a time when he read a bunch of his poems to a bunch of working class workers, and he wasn't sure how they were going to receive his work, but they ended up, like, some of them were crying, and they just loved it. And he talked about how well they loved him for what he was saying. And I love Neruda, but I like these guys like that. I like Ginsberg, and I like Luis Rodriguez. And I think we need to get into these issues. And poetry is a good way to talk about it, because it's just kind of neutral enough, or it's just kind of enough of a even playing field. You know what I mean? And poetry can be interpreted in different ways, so people can interpret it however they want.
That's right. They say it's much easier to reach people through art than through intellect.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's why music, dance, poetry is so effective.
Well, you know, being involved downtown as a broker kind of involves me in an ambivalent relationship with the owners, because they do great things.
Mm-hmm.
But yet some of what they do isn't so great.
Yes, I agree with you. I know what you mean.
But I do find that a lot of them, including some of what I might call the worst snorers still like poetry. So it's interesting. You kind of reach them. It may not change their behavior, mm-hmm. but you do get across.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to subject you to one of the poems I wrote about my favorite building that I worked on.
Let's do it. I'm listening. I'm ready.
I got it here in my iPhone.
Nice. What building?
This is about the Eastern Columbia building.
You know, that's one of my favorite buildings right. in LA. Claude Biellman was huge. And you know what else is, I'm sure you know this already, but Biellman did a bunch of really amazing buildings in downtown Long Beach. He did the Farmers and Merchant Banks on Pine Street in Long
right.
Beach. That is a masterpiece. 23. I mean, I love historic architecture. I'm glad you got a poem about the Eastern Columbia. I'm excited.
One of my former clients and one of the present clients, I think, owns that building right now.
That's one of my two or three favorite buildings in downtown L.A. 1930. Eastern Columbia's
great.
A masterpiece.
Jaded Deco. In 29, the owners raised her fluted sides of aqua terracotta and gold. They covered her in deep blue copper. They made a tower of gold lattice work and giant white clocks below their neon name, Eastern Columbia. They pressed a gold sunburst into her front facade to welcome the busy bodies of shoppers. A beautiful goddess rising in a vision above Broadway. The owners took gold from their own pockets before the age of credit. Her clocks hummed through the Great Depression and the war. My father-in-law had a job selling hats inside her in 36. Back then, the economist Jack Kaiser says the store was known for a catchy ad with a rising refrain. At Broadway and 9th, at Broadway and 9th. After the war, the suburbia craze hit. Developers moved on to Mid-Wilshire, and she passed from the founders to the founder's family. In the 1980s, the developer borrowed millions to make her a fashion center again. Now the hands of her clocks are stuck at 20 to 4. I'm the listing agent. Real estate gods, will I ever hang my sign as anything as beautiful as my goddess, Miss Eastern Columbia?
Yeah, I like that, man. I like that.
So you can't help but like these developers that did this kind of thing in the mm-hmm. 30s. Really mm-hmm. incredible. And some of them do it now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was reading.
Andrew Myron's one of my favorite clients. He's doing, I hope, finishing Clifton's. I don't know what he's doing now. It looks like he stopped, but he has that urge to preserve and take care of these historic properties almost as if they're people.
You know, developers can be visionaries if the right, you know, I mean, I just read this book called Makeshift Metropolis by Witold Rybinski, who's a really interesting urbanist. And his whole thing was that nowadays, what developers have to reconcile with is there's a different demand for what we need versus what people want. You know what I mean? And where do we find so he says the makeshift metropolis is kind of finding that halfway medium. But if you think about it, there are some of our developers, they have to be the visionaries if they can be. And nowadays, everything is so much guided by the dollar. So if these guys are the guys that make the decisions, hopefully we can have a few benevolent ones out there, or ones that are making intelligent decisions that are doing something for the community rather than just trying to fill their pockets, you know?
That would be very helpful. There's a whole bunch of developers that are nonprofit developers, housing developers. They pretty much rely on public funds like Century Housing.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of them in the historic area where I work.
That's
what
right.
do you see happening downtown? Why don't you give us, because, you know, you're not really a visitor. You've been here for quite a while. And I first saw you on a bus tour. Was that an esoteric tour?
Yeah, esoteric. Those are my friends right there, Kim and Richard. Great people.
Right. They are great people.
Yeah.
And then I said to myself, wow, this guy is incredible. Listen to him. You know, I was on there as a poet too, but I felt, God, what the hell is this? This street poet, street poetry style. Do you have another poem that before you reflect on downtown, that anything about these buildings or the urban metropolis that you could share with us?
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I have a lot of different ones. Let me do, this is one I did for Richard and Kim called Wurlitzer. It's about the Wurlitzer building, which
it's a fantastic building.
Yeah.
It's been redeveloped by Steve Needleman.
He was the guy that did Wiltern, right? In the library? Or
no, he's the one that's in the same block as Broadway Bar, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's part of the Needleman family.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
I just sold a building for them.
Oh, cool. Well, this is
that allows me to hang around like a flaneur for 6 months, and you know, you just talk.
Heck yeah. I like the flaneur, Baudelaire.
Pablo Neruda said after Garcia Lorca died that he was the greatest flaneur. Meaning a guy that whatever else he did, he liked to hang around and you know, sit in the cafe and observe. And just,
when I first heard that word, flaneur, however you pronounce it.
I'm sure I'm pronouncing it the Brooklyn version.
I saw it at the Getty Museum in the late 90s, and I looked it up, and it was all a person who sees their role is to observe man's movement through modern society. And Baudelaire was the guy in Paris that did that in a... I was like, wow, that's what I'm doing, because that's what I used to do. I mean, I still do it to this day, but when I was at UCLA, I would sit on Bruin Walk and watch people walk by.
Right.
And throughout my late 90s and early 2000s, you know, I've written thousands of poems at coffee houses.
I was the
guy sitting on a corner. I mean, and many times I'll sit on like 6th Street, or I'm on Main, or I'm on Spring. Not so much as I used to be, because I'm more with my wife and daughter nowadays. But in my single times, in my late 20s, early 30s, I wrote a lot of poems at coffee houses. And that flaneur was my thing. I love that.
Some cufflinks and ties.
I know. To get my dandy, dress up as... I know. This one is an acrostic poem, just a short one. It's called Wurlitzer.
Acrostic? What does that mean?
Yeah, acrostic, like acronym. Acrostic is when you spell the word down the side of the page.
Wow.
So it's one of my simple lesson plans I do with students. One of the first lessons I ever do when I teach a poetry workshop is the acrostic poem, because you could spell any word down the right. You could write your name, you could write Dodgers, you could write Lakers. But I've done a series of architectural poems where I spell the word down the side of the page. It's just for fun.
Well, that's great. See that? Listeners, tune in here. You get an education.
Acrostic poems is a secret I probably shouldn't let out, but... they're really good for like birthday poems or like wedding poems, or like I do a lot of like occasion poems, and the acrostic poem is a fun poem to do to just like customize for somebody. So this one is Wurlitzer, and it's just short, but Walker and Eisen designed the Wurlitzer building. Uncanny entablature, a decorative cornucopia. Regal columns, violins set back below Mozart. Lights bright enough to read after midnight. Illuminated architecture, music in the atmosphere, talking machines, silent film, and organs in the showroom, zoned into a $5 million musical storefront. Electrical decadence, Broadway's elegance, respect the mighty Wurlitzer building.
Wonderful.
So yeah, that's just a little, thank you so much. Yeah, I really
that's
like
one
that
of the
building.
Few buildings where the owner matches the building. And in other words, he has a high integrity.
When did Wurlitzer itself get out of there? 50s, 60s probably?
Yeah. I believe in the 50s.
Probably just there for 30 years, huh? I guess very few people stay the whole time. Like, it'd be great if the Eastern Columbia was still the department store, but now it's the Lofts. The department store closed in the 80s, right? Was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
It's incredible that, I think it closed before then, but when I see people with backpacks or shirts where it says Eastern Outfitters, and then I connect, wow, those were the same people that built that building that I love.
It's good that they're still around, because as you know, a lot of things don't even last that long.
Well, that building became an icon for redevelopment, Eastern Columbia. Mm-hmm. When Core bought it, there was a guy, Tyson Sales, that handled that whole transaction for them, and he loved the building, and he figured out a way they could develop it. So that's how somehow some of these developers really do come up with creative solutions.
I've heard good things about that Core.
Yeah. They do a nice job.
Yeah, I'm really glad they restored that. If I could buy a loft, that would be the one I would buy. I would buy an Eastern Columbia building if I could. Anywhere downtown, that would be the one I would personally choose myself.
Wow. What else you got there? Any more of these?
Yeah, you know what? Actually, this is one about the last bookstore. This is another little acrostic poem.
Now, that's the building I'm in. I'd like all listeners to know. That's where my office is.
Oh, cool.
And okay. Mike's been involved there. Are you running a poetry show there?
Yeah,
or you're
I do.
One
I
of
usually
a
do
group?
It on the fourth Sunday of the month there. And the last bookstore is one of my home bases, one of my main homes in L.A.
That's owned by one of my nicest clients, the Sue family.
They own the whole building there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great building. It was another Parkinson, huh? John Parkinson did all the spring,
John
man.
Parkinson and another Parkinson.
His
there
son,
were two
right?
of them. Yeah, they did almost every building I...
On spring.
Without them, I'd have no commission.
Man, well, here's to the
that
Parkinson's.
That was a joke. But, you know.
Here's to them on multiple levels because their architecture is...
Wonderful.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. This is just a little short one about the last bookstore, but... Last bookstore on Spring Street addresses the need for community, space, a place to exchange traditional papyrus and the interpersonal imperative. Books and records are physical presence, opening pathways of cerebral lanes, opportunities to gain wisdom, knowledge in the room to listen. Science serenades the vaulted ceilings, towers of books stretch for two floors, overtures of ideas exchanged and circulated. Records of light and nights of literary lore echo from the halls of the last bookstore.
Well, I guess I could skip this question. It says, what's the basis of your love for historic property? Do you have any poems which celebrate those buildings? I guess so.
you know,
what else? What do you think? Is, we want to go back to your social purposes and ask you about a recent important article that you did for KCET.
Yes.
But what is happening downtown? What do you see happening here? And... what's your view,
you know,
your gestalt of what is going on downtown?
I'm always, sometimes I am in the middle of a lot of issues and I...
Tell us about them.
As far as like, I love historic architecture, so I was glad to see the preservation of all these buildings and I support the adaptive reuse ordinance. And I was glad to see, you know, people moving down here. At the same time, I know it's sometimes there have been some issues about how do you reconcile with the poorer people of downtown.
Right.
And I mean, here we are in Skid Row Studios and I didn't bring it with me today, but I've actually written a poem about Skid Row. I probably should have brought that with me, but, I'm with you about income redistribution too. And so it's interesting because I'm glad that there is a rebirth in downtown and I'm glad that there's a preservation of these historic buildings. Now this is maybe even, sometimes I have more of an issue with not, I love the historic buildings. If anything I ever have an issue with, and I'm not really a guy of big issues, but maybe of the people that moved to downtown that are a little too oblivious. You know what I mean? That like, just, you don't have to, you can't give money to homeless all the time, but just have some respect, you know, like there's, I guess sometimes a lot of people's biggest issues with hipsters, for example, is that they feel like hipsters are just oblivious to everyone else. The hipster just wants to have his loud music and he thinks he's the only one there. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's true.
You know, it's, and so like, a lot of the issue, like as far as that is concerned, I've never really considered myself a hipster because if I went to a neighborhood, I'd try to be respectful of the history that was there before me. You know what I mean? And so like I've seen funny scenes I've seen on Spring, for example, was seeing some really dolled up young ladies, beautiful women carrying a bunch of shopping bags and you know, and they're walking by some homeless and I've seen the homeless guys look at them like, they're just a totally oblivious to the scene. Like, you know, you can go ahead and go shopping. Nothing wrong with going shopping, but you don't just ignore, like, and you can't be everybody's best friend either. I used to try to be everybody's best friend. I know that you can't do that either. I used to try to even befriend the antagonistic people. I know you can't always do that, but I mean, I find myself in the middle on these things where we need to be sensitive to other people. And like, and if you move into a neighborhood and there was people there before you, be aware of them and you can't kiss everybody's butt. But at the same time, like, so I am really big on respect, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but somebody once told me, you know, like the main rules of the street are treat everybody with respect and mind your own business. You know what I mean? So I see some things in downtown. I hope, I'm glad for the redevelopment. I'm glad for the preservation of the architecture. Now some of the crazy hipsters that are moving in, I like style and there's nothing wrong with that, but just they need to be more respectful of the whole big picture because there was something here before they were here.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm kind of, I have my own ambivalence about the area. I kind of grew up with people that are like, I don't even know if maybe some of these guys are from the projects in Rockaway that are out there on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I'm comfortable with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's just another day.
Yes, sir.
But not everybody can make it. Do you think that you need to have that same sense of respect on the part of the homeless towards the people coming to the area? Or is it only due from the newcomers to those that are already there?
You know, that's a good question. And as to the homeless, like, I think you do definitely need to be kind and respectful to them, but it's at the same time you can't. This is a different story, but I used to give a couple dollars to the homeless, but now with my daughter and things are tight, I can't really even afford to give a couple dollars to the homeless. So I don't ignore, like, I think there's a happy medium where you can, every once in a while, I still might give a quarter or, you know, a dollar here, not too much, but you don't have to kiss their butt, but you don't, at the same time, don't just be snobby and totally ignore them. And there's a fine line between the two. You know what I mean?
That's true. We all have to make an effort.
Yeah.
Say, recently, you wrote a really important prose article or blog for mm-hmm. KCET,
mm-hmm.
and you named several women in the LA cultural scene for their contributions, you know, moving things forward. Can you tell us about that? What was it? Was it an article? Was it a blog? How did you get in that position?
I have a weekly column I do for KCET called LA Letters. And I really...
Where does it show?
My beat, every Friday afternoon, it publishes about 5 in the afternoon on KCET, on their website, kct.org. And sometimes they've also had some video poems of mine that have aired a little bit on the station too, but... I do a weekly column for them, and sometimes they even have some audio links of my poems as well, but every week I'm always producing an article. But that article was about these women that are, most of them, are they're all various educators and artists in different ways, a little bit of, some of them are similar and some of them are kind of different, but they're all, for example, Ruth Nolan.
Right. I love Ruth Nolan, and she's going to help with the forward of my poetry book that's coming out.
She's going to do a great job. And I mean, not only is Ruth a great professor, but one of the things that really touched me about her that she was doing this workshop with these survivors of suicide out in the desert. And
wow.
Heavy. Nobody ever, those people who've tried to commit suicide, they're survivors of trying to commit suicide, and also their family members. And so I thought, wow, what a big heart she has.
Well, these family members that unfortunately had family
and some that had
committed suicide.
A couple of them have had family members that committed suicide.
Okay.
But everybody that was like in the Rancho Mirage or the Palm Springs, like it was, but I was like, she's a real humanitarian. She's got
That's
a really
right.
big heart. She really cares a lot. And I mean, I also have heard, I had one of her books and I liked it. And I'd also heard about what a great professor she was. But then I'm looking for different stories. And she's working with these people. And I was like, and people that have tried to commit suicide or had family members, that's a really very sad, tragic thing. And she was there trying to help those people. So I was like, she deserves some recognition. And she's pretty selfless. And, you know, she was never really looking for credit for it, but I was like, wow, Ruth Nolan is a heck of a great woman.
She's also like Miss Desert. I wouldn't go on. I mean, I'm well known for being lost in the desert, but I think she's more well known for being found, or she knows her way around.
Have you seen her book that was called No Place for a Puritan? And it's all these prose about the desert. I think you'd like it.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to look at that.
Heyday Prex, Heyday Books.
But what other women were mentioned in your weekly notice? And then you only do that once in a while where you cite outstanding citizens. It's not every week.
Yeah, you know, I try to jump around. Like sometimes I'm doing citizens, sometimes I'm doing like publishers. A couple of different people. One of the people I highlighted was a young lady named April Economides, and she's basically urban planner, kind of landscape, into landscape architecture. Well, one of the reasons I chose her was that she had gone to college in UC Santa Cruz, but she grew up in Long Beach, but she went to graduate school in San Francisco, and she lived in Portland, and she lived in the Bay Area. And I've actually known her 15 years, but she moved back to Long Beach she moved back to Long Beach 2 or 3 years ago. And what happened, though, was that all of these things that she had learned in Portland and San Francisco and she learned in grad school, she looked at Long Beach and saw that Long Beach had a really nice urban infrastructure for bicycles. And so she somehow worked within the city and got downtown Long Beach, and particularly the East Village Arts District in downtown Long Beach, to be the first bike-friendly business district in Southern California. And you know, she's just this girl in her mid-30s, but very smart woman, and she had a vision, and she was able to take these things that she'd seen in Portland and that were working in Berkeley and Portland and reapply them to her own home. And I thought, you know, what's better contribution than making your hometown a better place? And so this is a girl that grew up in Long Beach, and she had a lot of family roots in Long Beach. So I decided to write about April because she manifested all these things that she learned in grad school in Portland and then came back home and put it into place. And what are the other women? There was another woman, Alessandra Moctezuma, who's actually, she used to teach at UCLA, and now she teaches at Mesa College in San Diego. But she used to do a lot of work in LA on murals, and she was an art gallery director and gave a lot of breaks to a lot of young painters and people that I knew. And they had me perform poetry at their gallery in San Diego as well. But she's now in San Diego, but she used to be in LA. And so these people that I've tried to pay honor to, they're usually people that have also mentored young people, and they're like, they're great artists themselves, but also besides being great artists themselves, they're doing community work. Like Ruth Nolan is not only writing a book herself and being a great professor, but she was working with these people in this program, the suicide program, and the recovery from that, you know? And so I, like, in April, for example, she was trying to improve the built environment of Long Beach. And this woman, Alessandra Moctezuma, is interested in giving young artists their first break. And so I felt like these are some people that really deserve some recognition. And so that's why I decided to write about those women.
Fantastic. I'm so glad you're involved in that.
Thank you, Ed. Yeah, I mean, there's so many amazing people. I want to, you know, I try to write about as many of them as I can.
Well, yes, they're all making a contribution. You have anything more to tell us about downtown? What do you want to see happening here?
You know,
recently there was an art walk, and
I used to really love the art walk. It's a little hectic for me right now. I mean,
it's kind of become like a teeny bopper showcase, as if it's Disneyland or something. I can't see how that helps the artist.
Yeah, I know.
But recently there was a demonstration during the art walk, very disruptive. I think L.A. Can was involved in organizing it. I'm going to have them as a guest. Yeah. I know them. I'm sure I'm the only commercial real estate broker to do a poetry program with L.A. Can. I mean, they're not regarded in high favor in the development community. Do you know anything about that event? There was a disturbance. The art walk was set back. People became afraid of violence on the art walk. And a lot of the merchants lost money because obviously the customers aren't going to come in there when someone's smashing up the store.
And what were they protesting? Just that
the homeless, well, it's hard to say because Occupy LA was involved. And then I'm not sure if it was anti-uprooting the homeless or what it was about.
But
there was a lot of resentment.
I mean, I do.
You think that kind of activism is necessary to bring people's attention to what they call replacement of existing communities by gentrification?
You know, which, I mean,
or maybe you don't have an opinion on that.
No, I mean, they do. I mean, I understand where they're coming from. I mean, they do have a once again, it's like there's a happy medium. Like, how do you do? Sometimes there is no right way to do that. I mean, I understand their resentment in some way, like, okay, but at the same time, I mean, I'm in the middle of this because I'm glad that downtown is being improved. I mean, you know, it doesn't do anybody any good to have broken glass on the floor and you know what I mean? I know at the same time, like when you have gentrification like Times Square or Hollywood Boulevard, I mean, it gets a little too Disney-ified. You know, I mean, once again,
right.
I'm I find myself in the middle on a lot of these things where, like, there's a happy medium. Like, I mean, like, a little, you know, sometimes a little too many hipsters, too many, you know, coffee shops can be a little too much. But at the same time, I try not to always do it. But, you know, sometimes I'm drinking a Starbucks too. You know what I mean? In our day and age, it's impossible to almost, everybody is a little bit of a hypocrite. And anybody who thinks they're not is fooling themselves. You can't. The blood is on all of our hands. You know what I mean? As far as like everybody's wearing clothes made in sweatshops. I mean, I wish we could do more about it, you know, and you can do more about it. But anybody who gets to be too self-righteous is just young because I used to be that self-righteous in my 20s. But as you get older, there is a happy medium. You can be equitable and you can be for social justice and you can make a difference. But nobody is entirely innocent of it. Everybody, you know, you can really point fingers at just about everybody. That's why I no longer point fingers at people, because we're all guilty of something. You know
exactly.
What I mean?
Exactly. Well said.
All you can do is do the best where you're at. So what I try to do the best is by working with youth. I try to uplift youth. I try to empower youth. I try to write about the city and educate people. But I'm no longer so self-righteous that I'll criticize people too much. And a lot of people will do these things on Twitter and Facebook where they'll out somebody publicly and they'll have these bitter beefs and battles. And I'm not into that. That doesn't really do any good for anybody. And so, like, I concentrate my efforts on trying to be more positive and trying to uplift people. And I mean, I do understand the resentment, and I do understand that maybe there are too many hipsters sometimes coming in, and maybe there are some oblivious people that aren't respectful to the whole thing. But at the same time, these are beautiful old buildings, and it is good for downtown LA to be beautiful. So I wish I had more answers on these things, but I no longer...
Well, it sounds like you're the soul of moderation, when we could probably all use that.
Moderation, as you know, has a lot more longevity. You know? So, I mean, I wish I had more issues on this, because I've thought about a lot of these things a lot, you know? And... So, I mean, I'm glad that they have restored downtown. I want to find a happy medium. Let's just keep dialoguing about this over the next few years, man. There's plenty more to
hit. Yeah, there is a happy medium. I mean, one of the developers, Isaac Shomoff, he bought the Hayward Hotel years ago, and it was pretty run down and dangerous. Mm-hmm. And his approach was, he just gradually weeded out all of the tough people in the building, but left like 70% of the original occupants.
You know, if there's
his gentrification took place with the same people living in the hotel, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. So he improved it, but he didn't disrupt the lives of the, whatever, for lack of a better word, brothers and sisters living there who had been there for years.
You know,
which
what?
I think is fantastic.
Bless him for that.
He did pinpoint the ones that were really causing trouble, that were mm-hmm. violent, and got rid of them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's a really humble, you know, single mother that's working hard or a family or something, you know, all the, you know, yeah, absolutely.
So in that building, these hipsters you're talking about, they live in the same building as the original population on Skid Row, which is fantastic.
That's good.
So I think it can be done.
And, you know, and I'm not even really anti-hipsters, because I have plenty of friends. I guess they'd probably almost lump us in with that. But we've always tried to be more, you know, contributing to the whole thing. And, I mean, I love everybody. I give everybody the benefit of the doubt. You know what I mean? But I feel like it is true, like you're talking about. It is about having respect and trying to have a 360-degree perspective rather than just like a one-way perspective.
Right. Instead of... I'm not from the drill deeply type. I'm more of the broad, overall, shallow viewpoint. I like that. I don't like, I'm not given to deep analysis.
And, you know, I mean,
record keeping and all of that crap. I'm talking about a few things at a time here. Do you have any long urban poem you want to finish up with?
You know what? I'll do this.
That would be great. It's a great show, and you've touched on a lot of issues of social responsibility in downtown. Why don't you finish up with a poem, or if you want to keep talking about what your vision for downtown is.
You know what? I'll do this. I'm alive in Los Angeles, and wouldn't it be grand to hope to pick flowers at Figueroa? I'm alive in Los Angeles. I'm alive in Los Angeles. I'm alive in Los Angeles. And I'm alive in Los Angeles here in the wild, wild west. And as the warm wind hits my face, I walk across stained concrete. I cry tears of joy on Flower Street. I watch families dancing on their porches on Christmas Eve. I smile widely, and as I move through the city, my heart beats swiftly as sirens speed by me. I revel in the sadness. My soul is deep. I take full responsibility. Give me everything. It hurts. It's so beautiful. We got this universal, soulful, multicultural, emerging worldwide tribe people. I'm alive in Los Angeles. I'm alive in Los Angeles. And I'm alive in Los Angeles where there are more angles than isosceles. Citywide topographies undulate across massive landscape. We move from chain link to palatial gates into separate economic states with rising birth rates below hilltops in the streetscapes. One can barely even equivocate the fluctuations in rent so evident all across from block to block to block to block. Extravagance and adversity interlock. Palatial spots, crosswalks, burrito shops. Housekeepers are hanging out at bus stops, and the country club is all walled off, and the city's blowing up like a Molotov, and even when I'm in the shower, I'm hearing the horns honk. I'm alive in Los Angeles, and the neon crowns glow above the city of angels. Haze hovers after another nuclear sunset. I love it all. I'm alive in Los Angeles. L.A.!
Fantastic. You know, it would take 6,000 PhDs to say what you just did in about 1 minute.
Thank you so much, Ed. Thank you very much. Skid Row Studios, much respect, and thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks so much for coming here, Mike, and for touching upon the things you really care about in the city and in your poetry. And we'd love to have you back maybe in the, what is this, what season, summer? Maybe we could have you back in the fall.
Please, I'd love to. I had a great time, Ed. Thank you, man, and thank you for what you're doing, man. You're a great man. Appreciate you, Ed.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. Although